Our reading this morning is in the book of Genesis, and if there is a pew Bible nearby, please do take it up and follow the reading with us. First book in the Bible, Genesis, and we read from verse 12 to verse 36. Genesis chapter 37, Genesis chapter 37 from verse 12 to verse 36, continuing the story of Joseph. Genesis chapter 37 from verse 12. Now Joseph's brothers had gone to graze their father's flocks near Shechem. And Israel said to Joseph — Israel is another name for Jacob — Israel said to Joseph, "As you know, your brothers are grazing the flocks near Shechem. Come, I am going to send you to them." "Very well," he replied. So he said to him, "Go and see if all is well with your brothers and with the flocks, and bring word back to me." So he sent him off from the valley of Hebron. When Joseph arrived at Shechem, a man found him wandering around in the fields and asked him, "What are you looking for?" He replied, "I am looking for my brothers. Can you tell me where they are grazing their flocks?" "They've moved on from here," the man answered. "I heard them say, 'Let's go to Dothan.'" So Joseph went after his brothers and found them near Dothan. But they saw him in the distance, and before he reached them, they plotted to kill him. "Here comes that dreamer," they said to each other. "Come now, let's kill him and throw him into one of these cisterns and say that a ferocious animal devoured him. Then we'll see what comes of his dreams." When Reuben heard this, he tried to rescue him from their hands. "Let's not take his life," he said. "Don't shed any blood. Throw him into this cistern here in the desert, but don't lay a hand on him." Reuben said this to rescue him from them and take him back to his father. So when Joseph came to his brothers, they stripped him of his robe, that richly ornamented robe he was wearing, and they took him and threw him into the cistern. Now the cistern was empty, there was no water in it. As they sat down to eat their meal, they looked up and saw a caravan of Ishmaelites coming from Gilead. Their camels were loaded with spices, balm, and myrrh, and they were on their way to take them down to Egypt. Judah said to his brothers, "What will we gain if we kill our brother and cover up his blood? Come, let's sell him to the Ishmaelites and not lay our hands on him. After all, he is our brother, our own flesh and blood." And his brothers agreed. So when the Midianite merchants came by, his brothers pulled Joseph up out of the cistern and sold him for 20 shekels of silver to the Ishmaelites, who took him to Egypt. When Reuben returned to the cistern and saw that Joseph was not there, he tore his clothes. He went back to his brothers and said, "The boy isn't there. Where can I turn now?" Then they got Joseph's robe and slaughtered a goat and dipped the robe in the blood. They took their ornamented robe back to their father and said, "We found this. Examine it to see whether it is your son's robe." He recognized it and said, "It is my son's robe. Some ferocious animal has devoured him. Joseph has surely been torn to pieces." Then Jacob tore his clothes, put on sackcloth, and mourned for his son many days. All his sons and daughters came to comfort him, but he refused to be comforted. "No," he said, "in mourning will I go down to the grave to my son." So his father wept for him. Meanwhile, the Midianites sold Joseph in Egypt to Potiphar, one of Pharaoh's officials, the captain of the guard. Amen, and may God bless to us the reading of his word. So we turn again to the story of Joseph. And in this week's passage from verse 12 to verse 36 of Genesis 37, and please have it open in front of you and follow what's about to be said about that passage. In that section we can look at what's happening from, as it were, three points of view. We can look at the brothers, we can look at Jacob, and we can look at Joseph. And that's what we're going to do this morning. And what we see happening this week is the seeds of things that were sown earlier on in those first 11 verses. Those seeds growing, ripening, and bearing in each case for the brothers, for Jacob and for Joseph, quite awful, painful, bitter fruit. In the case of the brothers, seed that had to do with sin. They sowed hatred and jealousy. We see this week that that yields the fruit of murderous madness, of avarice, their desire for money, and of a kind of protective deception that will lie through its teeth over and over again. So when we look at Jacob, we see the seeds of the favoritism that he showed to Joseph, that richly ornamented robe, asking Joseph to go and make reports on his brothers and the way they looked after the sheep, that kind of thing. The favoritism that was sown now yields its own fruit. The robe that he gave comes back now blood-splattered and torn. He sees his family disintegrating about his ears, and he can do nothing about it. And he is left desolate and inconsolable in his grief. And for Joseph, well, he too has an awful and painful fruit of something in his life, suffering, degradation, being sent away, exiled, alienated from his people. But that's the fruit of him telling the truth. Telling the truth to his father, telling the truth to his brothers, being truthful, being open, being honest. And so this week the story starts with Jacob sending Joseph away to Shechem to look for his brothers. Perhaps an ill-conceived errand on Jacob's part. Perhaps not the wisest of things to have done. There would have been other servants who could have gone. But he says to Joseph, you go. Though the brothers, as we see earlier on in the chapter, hated Joseph for the report that he had once given about some of them. Again, Jacob sends them. Go and see how they're getting on. Come back and tell me what's happening. See if they're okay. And bring me back a report. Perhaps an ill-conceived errand that Joseph was sent on. But he is obedient. Wholeheartedly. He goes without any argument. He goes to look for brothers that he knows already hate him, despise him, can't stand him, don't have a good word to say about him or to him, as verse 4 of the chapter says. But he goes. And he goes wholeheartedly looking for his brothers. Jacob had said they're in Shechem, so he wanders. Well, not wandering, but he trudges through hot plains to Shechem, from the nice, cooler, more fertile valley of Hebron. And he doesn't find them. And at that point, Joseph could have gone back to his father and said, well, I went to Shechem, but I couldn't find them. They weren't there. He'd done his errand. He'd done his duty. He'd done all he committed himself to. But instead, he went on, heard they were in Dothan. So knowing that, he went looking for them. And eventually found them in the fields outside Dothan. Even at this early stage in the story of Joseph, we see something more than wholehearted duty. We see something more than Joseph simply fulfilling his father's instructions and affording that or according that obedience that was due to his father. Is there not here, even in this early stage, a hint of something in Joseph's life which we might find a little unnerving, which we might find almost naive? Isn't there even here, at this stage, a hint of what we will see emerging later on in the story, that Joseph actually loves and is genuinely concerned for the brothers who hate him. He is not merely fulfilling his father's will, going to Shechem and then on to Dothan and eventually finding them. It's his own concern. It's being a conscientious son and a concerned brother that sends him that extra distance. So Joseph compounds his transparent truth-telling with obedience and concern. We might call him naive. There might be something about Joseph which strikes us. It ought not to strike us like this, but perhaps it does, as being a bit simple and a bit blind to people. Joseph, they hate you. They can't stand you. Don't you realize what you're going to? Don't you realize, Joseph, that you are walking into the teeth of a trap? Maybe he did. Joseph is nobody's fool. But his conscientiousness and his concern motivate him. If ever there was anybody in the Old Testament who was not motivated by the desire for an easy, quiet, and comfortable life, then it's Joseph. And so we turn to the brothers. The brothers who were over near Dothan, and they see him coming. Him, that dreamer, they say. A term of contempt. It's almost spat out. That dreamer. Joseph's dreams that he told them really had got under their skin. As we were saying last week, if the brothers hadn't believed these dreams, if they'd thought that Joseph was just being silly, then they would have ignored them. But the brothers recognized something truthful in those dreams. There's something in those dreams which has got under their skin, which has raised their ire. There is something in those dreams which has really needled them, because there's some truth in them, as far as they can see. Here comes that dreamer. And the hatred and the jealousy that have become their habitual attitude toward Joseph, their wounded egotism, come to fruition. They're miles away from home, many, many miles away from home. They have ample opportunity to conceal their crime. And they have a motive. Let's stop those dreams coming true. Let's rid ourselves of the father's favorite and elevate ourselves a little in our father's eyes. Let's vent our hatred. They have opportunity. They can come up with an alibi. They have the motive. And the murderous madness overtakes them. Mad even by the culture of the day. According to the culture that these people lived in, you went to war against other people when a member of your own family was killed. When the blood of somebody in your family, a blood relative, was murdered, you went to war over it against other people. The thought of actually murdering a member of your own family was, at least outwardly, anathema. It was appalling. But these brothers are driven mad. They're driven mad. And so even before Joseph has got there, as quick as a flash, they hatch plan A. We'll kill him and we'll say that a wild animal has devoured him. Plan A. But at that point, Reuben enters the picture. Reuben heard this. He tried to rescue him from their hands. Verse 21. Let's not take his life, he said. Don't shed any blood. Throw him into this cistern here in the desert, but don't lay a hand on him. And then almost in brackets, almost sort of the thought bubble coming from Reuben's mind. Reuben said this to rescue him from them and take him back to his father. Now Reuben sounds as if he's being kind. Reuben sounds like the sort of older brother who comes in responsible, affectionate. He's going to come in and make sure that everything works out all right. But we have to stand back and remember something about Reuben. There are two things which make Reuben's intentions suspect. There is something to do with the culture. In the culture of the day, If Joseph's blood was shed, if Joseph was killed, even if it was by a wild animal, the responsibility for that death would fall on the oldest brother, on Reuben. The blood would be on Reuben's head. And Reuben would have to go back to his father and accept the blame, accept the guilt. There's something to do with the culture. There is also something to do with the context. Back in chapter 35 and verse 22, we read that Reuben went in and slept with his father's concubine Bilhah. Reuben is already in his father's bad books. He is already the oldest son who has blown it, we might say, with his father. Here is a golden opportunity for Reuben to rescue his father's favorite son, bring him home safe and sound, get himself back into his father's good books, safeguard his own inheritance as the eldest son, which was jeopardized, and also get himself well in with his father's favorite, so that in future years, when Joseph receives an inheritance which ought not to be his because he is his father's favorite, things will go well for Reuben too. And so Reuben looks nice on the outside, inside, no. Reuben hatches plan B. Don't kill him, don't shed his blood, throw him into the cistern. And he's thinking to himself, I'll sneak him out and I'll get him home to Dad later on. And they appear to go for this. The other 10 brothers appear to go for Reuben's plan B. It looks like they've swallowed it. And Reuben disappears from the picture at that point. Maybe goes to look after the sheep or the goats. We don't know. But he leaves the scene for a while. And when we come to verse 25, we realize that the other 10 brothers actually haven't gone for plan B. There they are, callously sitting down for a meal. Callously sitting down for a meal with their younger brother Joseph in the cistern there. And it transpires from what they say that they've never actually wanted to save Joseph's life at all. They see the caravan of Ishmaelites. Sometimes they're called Ishmaelites, sometimes Midianites. The Midianites were, if you like, a branch of the Ishmaelites. The term can be used interchangeably. In much the same way that we might say you're Welsh and British. Well, some people would say you're Welsh and British, or you're Scottish and British. The two terms cover each other. They see this Ishmaelite caravan coming. Traders going from Gilead on the best route down the coastal plain through to Egypt to sell their spices and the balm and the myrrh. And quick as a flash, Judah realizes that they have a better solution to the problem. They don't need to kill him, and you see from what he says that they're still thinking of killing him. Judah said to his brothers, "What will we gain if we kill our brother and cover up his blood?" And cover up our blood in verse 26 matches the phrase, "Say that a wild animal, a ferocious animal, has devoured him," back in verse 19. Quick as a flash, Judah recognizes that by selling Joseph to the Ishmaelites, they can first of all rid themselves of Joseph, which is what they want, and make sure those dreams don't come true. Second, they can get some cash into the bargain, 20 shekels of silver, the going price for a slave in the ancient Near East, even through to the 2nd century BC. The going price. They can get them get rid of Joseph, get some cash. But third, if the worst comes to the worst, and it's discovered that they've had a hand in Joseph's fate, they will be innocent of blood guilt. And this plan of Joseph is brilliant. Quick as a flash, the whole thing is sewn up. Judah has given them the perfect solution. And so they go for plan C. And his own brothers drag him out of the cistern, sell him to the Ishmaelites, and they get their shekels. It looks as though Joseph is all sewn up. The brothers have borne this fruit of madness, of a murderous intention, of avarice, and they compound it all with deceit. See how they go home to their father. The robe, of all the things that they could possibly have given to their father to wound him the most, of all the bitterest ironies that they could have inflicted upon their own father in a gesture of pure biting sarcasm, they give him back that robe, the symbol of the father's affection, the symbol of the father's honor of Joseph. Now blood spattered, they press home their lie, and they disown Joseph before his father and their father. Do you see, they say in verse 32, examine it and see whether it is your son's robe, not our brother's robe, your son's robe. And then this mock comfort, this callous, hard-hearted, vile comfort that they and their wives try to show to their broken father. Not even their father's brokenness moved them to tell the truth. And so to Jacob, the favoritism, the ill-conceived errand for Joseph, the lack of intervention, perhaps over years, to stop the family squabbling, now has yielded its fruit. His grief, the disintegration of his family, everything that he was hoping for his favorite son, now torn to shreds. But what of Joseph, the hero of the whole story? Well, it does look as if he has finally been sewn up. The net of his brother's hostility is closed around him. But when we look at Joseph, we're actually looking at something like a window. Because we look at Joseph and see beyond Joseph. We see through, behind Joseph, to the hand of God in the whole situation. You see, the very act which gave the brothers their desire, the very act which seemed to have sewn Joseph up forever, was in actual fact the very best thing that could ever have happened. For Joseph, his fate looked as though it was sealed, but what was actually sealed was the sure purpose, the sovereign plan, the perfect blueprint of God's purposes. God's purpose is not just to save Joseph's life from his brothers, but God's purpose is to save Jacob from his grief. God's purpose is to save the brothers, sinful, vile though they have been, to save the brothers. God's purpose to secure the future of the descendants of Israel. And by that divinely decreed family tree, God's purpose is to send a Savior. Because from Judah's line came David, and David's greater son, Jesus. At one level, family machinations and intrigue. At one level, something that modern novelists would give their eye teeth to be able to think of. But on another level, we see that sure-footed march of God through a family, through hatred, through terrible, terrible events, through power plays, through disaster. The sure-footed, steady march of God and of his purposes. Everything looks lost, but in actual fact, the door is only just opening. In that last verse, meanwhile, The Midianites sold Joseph in Egypt to Potiphar, one of Pharaoh's officials, the captain of the guard. Now this God is our God. How can we take the story of Joseph and even this part of the story of Joseph and apply it to our own lives? It's because we have the same God. The same God who can still use and does still use what appears to be disaster. The same God who steps in and makes good that which we suffer at other people's hands. The same God who by mysterious ways still saves sinners. This God is our God. And when he appears to be least present, he's not mentioned at all yet in the story of Joseph. When he appears to be least present, when the situation around us seems to be at its worst, and most mysteriously of all, in the midst of our sin, and in the midst of our pain, and in the midst of our darkness, this God is at work. We mentioned last week that phrase, the tunnel of chaos. This whole family has been plunged into the tunnel of chaos. And that's how it looks from a human point of view. And when we look at our own lives, either presently or in the past, and we can just about guarantee in days ahead, we are looking into a tunnel of chaos. Is God absent? Has God failed? Are his sovereign purposes thwarted? Never. Never. He is at work to save and to bless and to put us right, as he did with this family. The inconsolable grief of Jacob. The bitter hatred of the brothers. The terrible degradation of Joseph was but the prelude to one of God's greatest works, to one of the greatest blessings that we could imagine. Trust him. Trust him. He is a trustworthy, sure-footed God. And as we read on in the story, we'll see just exactly how true that became for those people.